Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So for the moment, we're going to adopt a format every week, which I'm going to pretentiously call dualities, to frame the discussion we're going to have. The reason I call them dualities is because I believe that more than anything else, it's the divided self, the tensions between our ideals and our realities, that creates new thoughts. Perhaps these thoughts are no better than the thoughts before, and perhaps they create their own dualities, or perhaps these thoughts lead us right back to where we were before. But for the moment, these dualities seem like they might be able to frame our discussion more illuminatively. So here are the dualities for this week. Duality number one, perpetual war for perpetual peace. Number two, mercenary army versus mercenary citizens. Duality number three, heroism versus nurturance. Duality number four, promotion of virtue by vice. Duality number five, the brothers Pertinax and Bernie. So we begin with this duality, whose title I think comes from Gore Vidal, but what he terms with disdain, I'm going to espouse reluctantly with a vague kind of approval. Perpetual war for perpetual peace. So before you crucify me, let's just focus on something slightly different for a second. Machiavelli has the answer to why we in America and our lucky streak may not continue as we've known it for much longer. Who knows, it might, but you know. So here's Machiavelli. A prince ought to have no other aim or thought nor select anything else for his study than war and its rules and discipline, for this is the sole art that belongs to him who rules, and it is of such force that it not only upholds those who are born princes, and it often enables men to rise from a private station to that rank, and on the contrary, it is seen that when princes have thought more of ease of arms than they have lost their states. And the first cause of losing it is to neglect this art. And what enables you to acquire the state is to be master of the art. For among other evils which being unarmed brings you, it causes you to be despised. You hear this hawkishness. I'm sure you hear it. But if you're listening, you hear this hawkishness, and you can't help but hearing, if you were politically active around 2003 when I was in college, perhaps the neoconservative echoes of Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, remember them? And hearing the mantra of what sounds so much like the mantra of a perpetual war machine should make a lot of us recoil in horror. But here's a fact that might surprise you. Neoconservatives hate Machiavelli. Leo Strauss, who's in some ways the original neoconservative intellectual, wrote a whole book, Thoughts on Machiavelli, arguing that virtually everything Machiavelli said was a discourse on why morality itself is a terrible thing. To neoconservatives with their dreams of using military force to end evil forever, Machiavelli is one of their great enemies. He's a proto-Foucault, or more perhaps at the point of proto-Nietzsche, who claims that all which matters is power, not morality. But at the same time, neoconservatives clearly owe so much to Machiavelli that it almost seems like Machiavelli is an Oedipal father figure they have to overthrow. Machiavelli merely claims that mastery of the art of war is what's necessary to preserve the peace, but neoconservatives take that doctrine to the nth degree and allege that implementation of war is how we implement peace. The most extreme neoconservatives would probably allege that the more total the war, the more total the peace that follows. And yet, as Iraq has shown far better than even Vietnam did, that utopian delusion that we can create a liberal peace from war is as fundamental a misunderstanding of the aims of war as can exist. Precise war, in which the targets are destroyed in the most strategic manner, can possibly create peace. But as Iraq showed, perpetual war can only create hatred. Here's Machiavelli again in the Discourses on Livy, and here he seems to be writing to us from a crystal ball about Iraq. a people who, being accustomed to living under governments of others, not knowing to reason either on public defense or offense, not knowing the princes or being known by them, return readily under a yoke which oftentimes is more heavy than that which a short time before had been taken from their necks. And they find themselves in this difficulty, even though the people is not wholly corrupt, for a people where corruption has not entirely taken over cannot but live at all free for a very brief time, as will be discussed below. And therefore our discussions concern those people where corruption has not expanded greatly and where there is more of the good than of the bad. To the above should be added another difficulty, which is that the state which becomes free makes enemy partisans and not friendly partisans. All those men become its enemy partisans who avail themselves of the tyrannical state, feeding on the riches of the prince, and who, when they are deprived of the faculty of thus availing themselves, cannot live content. And some are forced to attempt to reestablish the tyranny so as to recover their authority. So in addition to post-2003 Iraq, consider Russia in the 1990s, as we did last week. Everything we learned in Iraq, we should have already learned from our experience in overseeing the transition to capitalism in Russia. Only the transition in Russia was far, far more calamitous to the world than Iraq's ever could be. Which brings us to our next duality. Mercenary army versus mercenary citizens. So listen to this passage from the Prince. And it has always been the opinion and judgment of wise men that nothing can be so uncertain or unstable as fame or power not founded on its own strength. And one's own forces are those which are composed either of subjects, citizens, or dependents. All others are mercenaries or auxiliaries. Here in America, we have easily the world's largest army, 1.34 million active duty soldiers, and there hasn't been such a thing as conscription here for 45 years. It's all volunteers living a lifestyle of high discipline whose every ritual teaches them to love the republic for which they stand. So what happens if our army thinks the rest of us don't love our country as much as they do? What happens if our army thinks that we aim to change what the country stands for? What happens if they feel that the rest of us don't appreciate the sacrifices they make for us? The United States military has increasingly become a family business. 80% of the U.S. military now has members of the family serving in the military, and half the military is stationed in just five states: California, Georgia, Virginia, North Carolina, and Texas. Afghanistan is now by far the longest war in American history. Most Americans have forgotten about it and about the people who are still making sacrifices for it. Most American liberals have long since thought the war should have been over, and most progressives and socialists think that we're simply in a perpetual war to feed the military-industrial complex. On the one hand, we have people like Trump's chief of staff, General Kelly, saying that America doesn't understand the sacrifices the soldiers make. On the other hand, General Kelly did say this, admittedly, as a grieving father who just unfortunately lost his son in combat. But it was the armed forces themselves who decided that our not knowing the sacrifices of soldiers was to their benefit. Now, the podcaster Dan Carlin, to whom this podcast owes just about everything, alleges that this is because the powers that be have de facto banned us from seeing the sacrifices on television as Americans saw day after day during the Vietnam War, because if you see the sacrifices, you no longer want to make them. But that does not change the fact that ever more and more the military cannot wipe its nose without being documented in a free press. Every military death, both on our side and theirs, can be documented by journalists today. The problem today is that there is so much fake journalism to go along with the real thing that the atrocities of war can both be exaggerated by many and dismissed by others. Now, we in America have succeeded in promoting our way of life so well that we've fallen victim to its problems. Our press is so free that there is no accountability for when it's fake. When you have 3,000 outlets to help you decide what you believe rather than three, you're going to believe the outlets that tell you the alternative facts that fit with the theories you've already held. Therefore, the more one side of the argument refuses to see that America is not blameless in its conflicts, the more the other side is going to insist on shouting the war crimes we're to blame for from the rooftops. And pretty soon, every moral gray area becomes black and white. Nearly half the country will believe America does not commit atrocities, and nearly half the country will believe we commit only atrocities. And that's pretty much where we are as a country already. And this doesn't just go for news about the military. This goes for military history as well. So for many millions, the military sacrifice will become something to venerate beyond any other kind of sacrifice. And for other many millions, military sacrifice only seems like what American military people inflict on other people. So if this is what our country is now, then we no longer have an army fighting to protect its country. Rather, we have almost the same army of professional soldiers who existed in Machiavelli's Italy. The difference is that from the soldiers' point of view, we are the mercenaries. And who can quite blame them? A government that can't pay its debts gets involved in wars it can't end. That's the America of 2018. After the nation building it did in Iraq and Afghanistan, the average American soldier knows more about building infrastructure than the average construction worker. He knows more about how to maintain the rule of law than the average policeman. And given how clearly war has shifted to the internet, the average soldier might in 20 years know more about computer coding than the average programmer. Machiavelli would ask us what army of hired soldiers would fight with real passion for a monarch or a noble when they can always switch loyalties to a higher bidder or a ruler whom they think will potentially be better. But what happens when the military thinks it can switch loyalties from its ruler or its republic to itself? It's happened in so many other countries already. How many people still think America is the exception? So with all that in mind, listen to this passage and try to reinterpret it with modern ears. They are ready enough to be your soldiers while you do not make war, but if war comes, they take themselves off and run from the foe, which I should have little trouble to prove, for the ruin of Italy has been caused by nothing else than by resting her hopes for many years among mercenaries. And although they formerly appeared valiant amongst themselves, yet when foreigners came, they showed what they were. Thus it was that Charles, King of France, was allowed to seize Italy with chalk in hand, and he who told us that the cause of it told the truth. But they were not the sins he imagined, but those which I have related. And as they were the sins of princes, it is the princes who have suffered the penalty. I wish to demonstrate further the infelicity of these arms. The mercenary captains are either capable men or they are not. If they are, you cannot trust them, because they always aspire to their own greatness, either by opposing you, who are their master, or others contrary to your intentions. But if the captain is not skillful, you are ruined in the usual way. If the last 35 years are any indication, corporate profit margins, we're going to switch gears ever so slightly, can get still higher and higher while creating less and less product. Industries can decline while captains of industry can get ever richer. So when we talk about the military-industrial complex, a complex that has always been true for just about every powerful country in the history of the world, we've only seen the tip of how powerful the military-industrial complex can grow. Think of modern states like Pakistan or Egypt, where the military is the only competently run part of the country. Every industry, every civil institution, every government apparatus eventually declines into dysfunction. Only the military has the discipline to provide public services from generation to generation, and all they demand in return is absolute power over the rule of law and the treasury. Can this happen in America? Of course it can. Will it? Well, it's just one of a couple hundred different disasters that can befall this extremely decadent country of ours at any moment, and yet we've avoided nearly all of them so far, so why should we think that that streak won't continue? And that brings us to our next duality, heroism versus nurturance. So listen to this passage from Machiavelli. There is nothing proportionate between the armed and the unarmed. It is not reasonable that he who is armed should yield obedience to he who is unarmed, or that the unarmed man should be secure among servants, because there being in the one disdain and the other suspicion, it is not possible for them to work well together. So let's not even think of the army for a minute. Just think of Red America versus Blue America. One is armed to the teeth. Not just professional soldiers, though it's worth noting that of the 10% of the country that's veterans, 2 in every 3 generally vote Republican. But this Red America also includes the vast majority of the possessors of the 300 or so million privately held firearms in this country, at least the firearms that are registered, not to mention the most reliable block of Red America within Blue America, the police, who have readier access to firearms than anyone in America and more legal means at their disposal to use them by far than even soldiers on active duty. Now, this means two things. One, there's a fundamental difference in the ethos between the two sides of American life, one of which believes in arming itself and the quality which always accompanies those who crave conflict, heroic self-reliance. the urge to prove oneself against obstacles, which means that if there are no obstacles in their way, they have an unconscious urge to create obstacles for themselves to overcome. For example, making enemies of people whose natural inclination would be to support and welcome them to an extent which their communities never have. Against them are those who don't arm themselves precisely because we crave a peaceful life free of conflict. We don't want to be heroic. We want to support each other. We want to rely on each other. We want a community. And therefore, those who do not want to be part of our community of support are viewed with just as much disdain and suspicion. Machiavelli doesn't specify which side is disdain and which side is suspicion. And therefore, number two, there will inevitably be conflict between these two sides, and inevitably the better armed side will win almost instantaneously. It is up to those of us on the more nurturant, liberal side of the debate, the Barack Obamas, the Hillary Clintons, to be the more conciliatory voice of reason. What the Bernie Sanderses and the Elizabeth Warrens of America fail to understand is that our side does not have anything like the armaments to provoke the other side. If we can cool down the temperature of the debate, we can win. If the temperature goes up, we lose instantly, just as happened in 2016. So let's just say for a moment that the impossible happened and that Bernie Sanders became president as so many socialists alleged would have happened had he been nominated rather than Hillary and faced Trump. In the episode about The Godfather, we talked 2 weeks ago about the coup in Chile against Salvador Allende. I have no idea what sort of president Bernie Sanders would have actually been. The actual policies he presented were barely more progressive than Franklin Roosevelt, and it was merely the temperament with which he advocated it that made him so revolutionary. In some ways, Sanders brought the worst of both sides to bear. Had he proposed more radical proposals more subtly, he might have effected the change he wanted to see. But had he done even a small fraction of what Allende did, if he implemented any kind of fundamental change as our president, any at all, and advocated for it with the kind of scorched earth brimstone which he spoke with on the campaign trail, he may very well have provoked a coup d'etat. The only way to have prevented it is if socialists and progressives armed themselves to the teeth in the manner conservatives do, but if they armed themselves the way the conservatives do, they would cease to represent the supportive, nurturant view of the world they espouse. They would become militants like Che Guevara and Maximilian Robespierre, and become the violence that they claim to detest. So let's just say that an American Che came into conflict with an American Pinochet. Economically, financially, militarily, we are a much more developed nation than Chile or Cuba, so the death toll would have been exponentially more catastrophic. The nature of the world is conflict. If you seek conflict out, you will find it. If you deliberately avoid conflict, the conflict will find you. The only way to avoid conflict is not to make peace, but to make peace with conflict. Accept its inevitability. Accept that you will never live in a world where conflict can come even close to banishment, but only minimized like a terrorist whose ransom has to be paid. The ransom in this case is vigilance. It's the acceptance that the world, to stay peaceful, must always be ready for war. Reluctant and ever aware of its horrors, but realizing that the notion that the world would ever exist without war is dangerously false. The military-industrial complex is what has provided rule of law from the beginning of time. The proper question is not how we can dismantle it, because if we don't control the world militarily, China or Russia will certainly step into the vacuum we create. And it's naive to think that they will be anything in their treatment of smaller countries, but much worse than we've been. So the proper question is not how America's military-industrial complex can be dismantled, but how it can be maintained in the most peaceful, unobtrusive, liberal manner that's of benefit to society rather than to its detriment. Which brings us to our next duality, the promotion of virtue by vice. Many Bernie Sanders supporters point to Northern Europe as the ultimate place which shows that a peaceful social democracy living in harmony with its neighbors is absolutely possible. They don't really think to look at how Northern Europe has done so with a ruthless immigration policy and how ruthlessly it treats the immigrants who arrive, even by American standards. But here's the truth. Machiavelli might have been taken in by Northern European prosperity too. Don't assume that Machiavelli was a complete realist. Even Machiavelli had his moments when he was taken in at times by the same naivete the rest of us have. Consider his admiration for the Germany of his time. Here's what Machiavelli has to say about the German-speaking lands of 1500. And while you're listening, think of the Northern European lands of half a millennium later. The cities of Germany are absolutely free. They own but little country around them, and they yield obedience to the emperor when it suits them, nor do they fear this or any other power they have near them, because they are fortified in such a way that everyone thinks the taking of them by assault would be tedious and difficult. See, they have proper ditches and walls, they have sufficient artillery, and they always keep in public depots enough for 1 year's eating, drinking, and firing. And beyond this, to keep people quiet and without loss to the state, they always have the means of giving work to the community in those labors that are the life and strength of the city, and on the pursuit of which the people are supported. Do you hear that? That's European social democracy, circa 1500. It's hard not to hear Machiavelli describe the Germany of this time and not think that he's in fact describing the Germany or the Switzerland or the Sweden or whichever else of 2000 or 2018. But in 1500, the German-speaking lands were literally on the precipice of 150 years of theological bloodshed, culminating in the 30 Years' War, whose casualties to Northern Europe were proportionally worse than even World War II or the Black Death. History never stops, and just when you think you've solved history's problems, a new one is created. The only option left to us is to use the vices of individuals as the means to check one another. Machiavelli knew this just as well, so consider what he says in the Discourses on Livy, the other book which is still read today, in a passage which seems much more like a response to Plato's Republic. Desiring, therefore, to discuss the nature of the government of Rome and to ascertain the accidental circumstances which brought it to its perfection, I say, as has been said before by many who have written of governments, that of these there are three forms known by the names monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, and that those who give its institutions to a state have recourse to one or other of these three, according as it suits their purpose. Other, and, as many have thought, wiser teachers will have it, that there are altogether six forms of government, three of them utterly bad, the other three good in themselves, but so readily corrupted that they too are apt to become hurtful. The good are the three above named, the bad three others dependent upon these, and each so like that to which it is related, that it is easy to pass imperceptibly from the one to the other. For a monarchy readily becomes a tyranny, an aristocracy an oligarchy, while a democracy tends to degenerate into anarchy. So that if the founder of a state should establish any one of these three forms of government, he establishes it for a short time only, since no precaution he may take can prevent it from sliding into its contrary, by reason of the close resemblance which, in this case, the virtue bears to the vice. I say, then, that all these six forms of government are pernicious. The three good kinds, from their brief duration, the three bad from their inherent badness. Wise legislators, therefore, knowing these defects, and avoiding each of these forms in its simplicity, have made choice of a form which shares in the qualities of all the first three, and which they judge to be more stable and lasting than any of these separately, for where we have a monarchy, an aristocracy, and a democracy existing together in the same city, each of the three serves as a check upon the other. So who that has even a passing knowledge of the Federalist Papers can hear this passage and not think of James Madison? Surely the idea for three branches of government to check and balance each other had to be derived in part from this. In the American system, in any democratic system or modern Republican system, human vice, human sin is the engine that people use so that worse vices and sins are never perpetrated. In the 20th century, we had a great experiment to base a system of government on human virtues, and the experiment covered half the world. The death toll was well over 200 million. And it would seem that history shows over and over that if there is no political check on the most altruistic human urge, the urge to share with and give to and save others, this will to kindness will either be exploited or turned into the urge to hurt those who don't have the exact same altruistic urge you do. But let's talk for a moment about the opposite. What about those people who have not the same urge to help that you do, but who have rather an urge to hurt, which you do not share? This may come as a shock to people who haven't read Machiavelli, but Machiavelli viewed the republic as the best form of government, and his reason was typically hard-headed. He believed that only in a republic would there be a proper citizen army that truly fights to defend itself. Here's Machiavelli. Experience has shown princes and republics single-handed making the greatest progress and mercenaries doing nothing except damage. And it is more difficult to bring a republic armed with its own arms under the sway of one of its own citizens than it is to bring one armed with foreign arms. Rome and Sparta stood for many ages armed and free. The Switzers are completely armed and quite free. And the Switzers are still quite free with their mandatory conscripted army. We do not have a conscripted army. Neither do most first world countries. But let's be honest, it's been 500 years since Machiavelli, and what if in such time we've evolved into precisely the opposite problem, that our army is so citizen-based that we've created a professional class of armed forces within our citizens which feels no loyalty to their other citizens, which brings us to our final duality, the brothers Pertinax and Berni. What does it mean, ultimately, to earn the enmity of people who can easily thwart your desires in the name of virtue? Everyone who wanted to nail Hillary to the cross for speaking at Goldman Sachs or the Clinton Foundation's cozying up to Saudi Arabia really ought to consider this passage from Machiavelli about the Roman Emperor Pertinax. But Pertinax was created emperor against the wishes of the soldiers, who, being accustomed to living licentiously under Commodus, could not endure the honest life to which Pertinax wished to reduce them. Thus, having given cause for hatred, to which hatred there was added contempt for his old age, he was overthrown at the very beginning of his administration. And here it should be noted that hatred is acquired as much by good works as by bad ones. Therefore, as I said before, a prince wishing to keep his state is often forced to do evil, for when that body is corrupt whom you think you have need to maintain yourself, it may be either the people or the soldiers or the nobles, you have to submit to its humors and gratify them, and then good works will do you harm. The ascension and murder of Pertinax is one of the first great sections of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, though I say one of the first great sections on faith, because of, to be honest, I've only gotten about 12 chapters in to that enormous opus, which I'm sure is worth a time investiture I've not yet put into it. But let's face it, I'm not a real intellectual. I just play one on the internet. One day, if we keep going with this podcast, I have a bad feeling it will be all too rewarding to occupy ourselves for a good month or two on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, if not for a full 6 months. The reason to mention the story of Pertinax is to ask ourselves, who are the equivalents in our day to the Praetorian Guard who killed so potentially noble an emperor? Obviously, being a soldier in today's world, or even a member of the Secret Service, is not nearly as lucrative an occupation as it was to be a member of the Roman Emperor's Praetorian Guard. The licentious living does not exist among the American military. It exists in corporate America, and there is nothing corporate America will not do to make sure that it will stay prosperous. It's a simple fact of worldwide life, and maybe some of you listeners are willing to undergo a second French Revolution to behead our corporate aristocrats so that we can start off half a dozen wars, but I'm not. Like the Praetorian Guard, corporate America is not inherently evil. The system has just allowed them to grow much too powerful. I'm certainly willing to believe that the disproportionate power of both of them drew a higher than average percentage of psychopaths and narcissists. But the reason they act so narcissistically is not because of the inherent character flaws of their members, but because they know that the best guarantee of achievement in it is to make them more money. And therefore, every individual within the company knows that if they try to scale back the operations over ethical considerations, someone else, more ambitious and more ruthless, will inevitably take their place. Now, left-wing radicals point this out every day, and they see it as the ultimate indictment of capitalism. The fact that the capitalist system itself has more agency than any individual, whom, when he shows any ethical sense to be generous to the workers under him, can be replaced by a more cutthroat colleague. Who knows? Maybe they're right that capitalism is inherently evil. And many of these radicals will even call this system late capitalism and take it as an inevitability that the system is decadent and going to be overthrown. I certainly don't think they're right about that, because even if a lot of listeners may acknowledge the enormity of what this behemoth controls, they don't acknowledge the enormity of the costs to try a different system. Just look at Russia in the 1990s again, and think of the price they paid for a revolutionary transition from communism to capitalism, a price they're still paying and whose price they're now visiting on us through Trump and fake news and probably 100 other ways we don't know about. And to inflict, because that's the only word for the change, which many suggest, a revolution on America, whether socialist or capitalist, would, as happened in Russia, create economic super depression that might even dwarf the Great Depression. On the other hand, the hypercapitalist system we seem now to be implementing with the Trump tax cuts and the entitlement slashing that may be coming soon may cause a super depression anyway. But whether or not this super depression ever occurs, there is no guarantee that we come out of the other side of a super depression with a social democracy or a series of anarchist collectives. And I place the odds that we won't at well over 99%. The interests of corporate America are so vested, and the means at their disposal are so vast, not just their private means, of which they have trillions, but in their control over public funding through lobbies, that they can find an infinite number of ways to bribe the armed forces, not just the traditional armed forces, but the police and citizen militias too, to guarantee the safety of their persons and families and their wealth and their friends and their allies, and then to increase it more than ever. And when that happens, we will truly not be either a republic or a social democracy, but truly the Roman Empire reincarnated. This is the part where I wanted to read to you Gibbon's whole description of Pertinax's ascension and assassination so you could draw parallels with what might have been possible had Bernie Sanders become president, or if a Bernie-like figure becomes president in the next 15 years. But we don't have time for that. What we do have time for is to say that if this podcast is to be something worth doing, it's worth keeping going even through the dull bits. And we're still only two-thirds of our way through what there is to say about Machiavelli. Who knew that a classic book would contain so much that's still relevant?
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find these and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?